You're listening to the Two Tongues Podcast. And now your hosts, Kyle and Chris.
Welcome back, one and all, to another episode of the Two Tongues Podcast. Today we're going to do something a little bit different. I'm hoping this will just be kind of a shorter episode, but I just kind of wanted to talk about something that's been on my mind a bit. Came up in a conversation with Kyle and a couple times before, and it has to do with the existence of spirits, angels, demons, supernatural, invisible beings, fairies, whatever you want to call them. We've called them all kinds of different things throughout the course of human history. And as a rational Western modern man, I've been critical to the idea. It's not been obvious to me that those things are more than mere mythology. It's not been obvious to me that what a spirit is, what an angel is, might mean something different than the meaning that we generally attribute to them in the modern world as like necessary. Well, I mean, we think about the moral of fables. We think about the parables that Jesus spoke. We think about myths in a lot of the same ways, that we're learning something from them, that we're telling the stories for a reason, so that we're passing on some information. And the existence of spirits is one of these themes. It's one of these things that we're trying to remember, that we're teaching our kids even. And what the reality might be of real supernatural beings, I don't know. But it's something that I've resisted. It's something I've considered to be woo, something beyond the pale of, metaphysical ideas that I take seriously, like the idea, like the existence of God, let's say, something I would take seriously. They've kind of fallen outside of that. And I don't know if it's fair for me to have done that. I think it's possible that there's another way of understanding what angels and demons might be, from even from a Christian or religious perspective, that maybe demands that it be taken more seriously. And I think there are a lot of conservative religious people that will probably not like the direction that I'm going to take this, but I think the truth is, the fact is, there are things that we talk about in spiritual language or religious language that have reality, real existence in the world, even in the material world, in the physical world, not just in some la-la land of spirit realm that we talk about and you know, never really point to or can't really point to. I think that there's a principle of correspondence. This is something that the neuroscientists will talk about, and the philosophers of mind. There's some kind of correspondence between the spiritual world and the material world, and that there may be a way of understanding spirits, angels, demons, that kind of thing, that can be looked at through more of a physical, material lens. I'm not saying that the existence of angels or demons is only material or only physical. No, obviously not. We're talking about whatever it is we mean when we use the word spirit is something different, but it has some correlation in the physical world. It's connected to something in the physical world, and I want to try to explain that. I want to kind of talk through this with you guys, and you tell me what you think. I haven't had a chance to think about this super deeply, so take it for what it is, but here we go. I'm going to call this episode Angels, Demons, Spirits, and Gods with a lowercase g. Now, I make that distinction, of course, because God with an uppercase G is the Almighty, the God of monotheism, the idea that whatever God is one thing and one thing only. That's an idea that I sort of, you know, I empathize with, I believe. And we're going to kind of have to go a different direction here, but while we're talking about angels, demons, and spirits, we also kind of have to throw in this category, gods with a lowercase g. So think about the gods of the ancient Greeks, the gods of the ancient Egyptians. Think about those. All right, so here we go. Recently, I've had occasion to reconsider the theological ideas of incorporeal spirits or beings. As I said before, my brand of radical monotheism has always seemed to rule out any spiritual reality apart from God. God is spirit. Spirit is God. Period. The end. There's no room for any other or lesser divinities. God is God. There is no other gods. But when we look at the religious beliefs from prehistory to antiquity, from the classical period all the way up to our modern one, very few religious people seem to see it this way. I often speak of tribal societies and prehistoric societies whose animistic worldview presumes the cosmos to be populated by spirits. The world is full of spirits. Spirits embodied in human beings, plants, animals, but also in nature in a more abstract way, like the spirit of the mountain, the spirit of the sea, the sky, and the stars. And we can easily see the evolution of this belief system as it progresses to the classical period. When we look at the classical religions and the classical pantheons like the Sumerians, the Egyptians, the Greeks. In these systems, the idea of spirit has taken more definite form. Okay, rather than imagining the spirits of nature as formless somehow, we see them human-like, anthropomorphic, with distinct personalities and histories. We can see preserved in them the spirit of the sea. You know, the Greeks called that spirit Poseidon. Spirit of the sky, Zeus. And we still have personal spirits too. The Greeks called them daemons. It's like the spirit of the self or the ego, the spirit that you call you, whatever the spirit is that's in you that you identify with, whatever that is. They called that daemon, a daemon. Of course, that word is related to demon, so that's a little weird, but also spirits of nature like Pan and Artemis. So just like the spirit of the mountains, they've got the Greeks have gods like that. But in the classical pantheons, we begin to see other types of spirits. Spirits that embody not physical objects, but psychological ones. The Greek god Mars, for instance, was the god of warfare. He represented a spirit, all right. But this was the spirit of war. Protective and vengeful, rather than any particular war. And Eros, similarly, was the goddess of sexual love. She could be called the spirit of lust, or the spirit that drives towards procreation. Another key example would be Hestia. As goddess of the hearth, she represents the spirit of community, or the spirit under which people become united, as we do when we gather together around a campfire or fireplace. If this seems obscure, think about the feeling of patriotism, or the feeling of having pride in your family or ethnic or group identity, or of losing yourself in a communal experience, like at a sporting event or a concert or a church service. You know, these feelings like when the crowd goes wild and everyone stands up and screams at the same time, it's like you're doing something together and you lose some grasp on your individual being and you become expanded into this communal being, you know? This is like the spirit of Hestia. So these psychological spirits are not like the spirits of nature out there. They're within somehow. They seem like a force which possesses us temporarily, then removes their influence. This is how we feel, after all, when filled with rage or with lust, isn't it? We could describe it as a spirit seizing us in a moment of passion and overriding our conscious control. We become personally powerless at the whim of the spirit. And Jordan Peterson describes these kind of psychological spirits as transpersonal. They're personal in that they arise within us individually and can only be controlled by effort of our will. But they're also transpersonal in that everyone is susceptible to them equally. They are a constant reality to each and every one of us and influences us in identical ways. Now, as a human being, I can't dismiss the reality here described. I have been possessed by these spirits myself, even if I might not have always described it this way. Now, moving from the classical pantheons into contemporary monotheism, we carry forward the animistic worldview in a kind of a clandestine way. Rather than considering a cosmos populated by spirits, we instead conceive of angels and demons. Now, what's the difference, do you think, between this primitive idea of spirits, the classical idea of a pantheon of gods, and the Christian one of angels and demons? It's a damn good question, it turns out. As much as conservative Jews, Christians, Muslims insist that there's only one God, they are awfully quick to accept lesser spirits which coexist with the Most High God. Is this polytheism? Are they worshiping multiple gods? See, it always seemed to me to be so, but I'm beginning to see a new way. When I reflect on my own mystical experience, I'm overwhelmed by this revelation of ultimate unity which that experience imparts. The mystical experience reveals not only a common origin and essential interconnectedness between all things, also an ineffable knowledge of mutual counterdependence, which is a fancy way of saying the existence of everything relies on the existence of everything else. They're mutually counterdependent. You can't have one without the other. It's either all or nothing. And one comes out of this mystical experience saying things like, all is one, and all is God. And naturally, this generates an intuition towards monotheism. But it also generates a paradox. The mystic knows that all is one, and yet he finds himself nonetheless separate from the world. The mystic finds himself simultaneously one and many, and with the same certainty understands that God must be therefore both one and many. In trying to work through the mystical paradox, I find myself appealing to the Christian Trinity, the idea that God is both one and many. In this model, I understand a kind of internal separation or dissociation has taken place, which allows God to be many, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, and yet retain its unity as one God. In the same way, I see God's creation, myself included, as one and many. It is true that God is the divine unity, and that this unity exists as me. I am one of an infinity of incarnations, each of which is identically God. I can't help but smile that this worldview so closely mirrors the animistic one. The cosmos of spirits, it seems, comes full circle. So here's the thing I'm coming to realize. If I can understand myself to be one with God and yet exist as an individual, why am I so close-minded to the idea of lesser divinities, of angels and demons? Should material beings be the only incarnations of God? Am I so certain that the unity of God might not also extend to realms beyond the physical? If God can be the cosmos and all the things in it, why can't it also be angels and demons? As radical in my monotheism as I claim to be, I have no ready arguments against this possibility. And so I was trying to come up with a model of reality that would capture all of this, one that would allow me to see gods or angels as dissociated incarnations of God in the same way I understand myself, but also as forces capable of acting upon me. Right? This is what demons are supposed to do, or angels even, to have some influence, some to act upon me. It was at this point in my thinking that I was reminded of that idea of the transpersonal. Okay, so consider this. Rather than the gods or demons permeating the world and influencing people from the outside in, might they already be on the inside? I mean, if all is one, then everything is on the inside, so to speak. What if we're carrying angels and demons around with us, metaphorically, maybe even literally? What if they are actually inseparable from us? This would explain how they are transpersonal, now wouldn't it? It would explain the religious idea of spiritual warfare from which we cannot escape. It even puts a new spin on original sin. You know, perhaps the words of the serpent were whispered to Eve from within. Now, this does not diminish the reality of the Eden story, at least not to me. It concretizes it. Now, we can consider the voices within our heads differently. The voice of conscience, the voice of temptation. These voices are very much real. They are motivational forces with which we must contend. But this begs the question, what is it we're calling a motivational force? What is it we're calling ourselves? All of these are spirits. The thing I call I, my consciousness, my ego, this is a spirit. The motivational forces that act within me, they too are spirits. And they're all seemingly rolled up into one composite being. I can't help but think about a scene from The Exorcism of Emily Rose. If you haven't seen that movie, I recommend it if you like horror movies. There's a moment where they're trying to exorcise the demons from her, and she says they're trying to get to figure out the name of the demon that's possessed her, so they can get some sort of power over the spirit. And the spirit says, "I am legion." It's like, "I am legion." There's a whole bunch of demons in that girl. There's a whole bunch of spirits existing within her. "I am legion." That's kind of a similar picture to what I'm painting. All these spirits rolled up into a composite being. It's like within my mind, like the occupants of some great house, reside a host of beings. Most would have no trouble understanding this as a psychological idea. We can say that our psyche is made up of all sorts of competing drives, as well as an overarching ego, which mediates between them. Within each of us is the spirit of lust, the goddess Eros, the instinct to procreate so that our genes perpetuate into the future. Within each of us, the spirit of conflict, the god of Mars, the instinct to defend body and kin and territory. And within each of us, the spirit which encounters these and reconciles them towards a common purpose, that's the ego. Now, if we return to religious language, we would be saying something like, in creation, God made from himself not merely the physical cosmos, but a multiplicity of spirits. These spirits embody those drives necessary for sustaining existence. The spirit towards survival, towards procreation, towards protection of life and young, the spirit of kinship and identity, the spirit of adaptation and transformation. All of these spirits were necessary, without which beings like you and I could not exist. We have evidence from biology and neuroscience that supports this. We're told that primitive creatures have more primitive brains, and that evolving from them, we retain vestiges of them in our own brains. Our reptilian brain, as they call it, refers to the basal ganglia, which controls unconscious processes and instinctual behavior, followed by the paleomammalian brain, or limbic system, which controls emotion, and finally the neomammalian brain, or neocortex, which makes rational thought and self-consciousness possible. So consider the age of the dinosaurs for a second, when the reptilian brain was the height of cognition. Every creature existed sheerly on instinct. They saw prey and killed it, got fatigued and slept. They were cause and effect creatures. We can't blame a crocodile for snatching up a kid on the riverbank. It's not an evil act, since there was no choice in the matter. But you see, we have that thing in us and feel those same drives. We still have that reptilian brain in us. And it would be evil if we exercised them. You see where I'm going? Could it be that the spirits which ensure survival are the very same spirits we call angels and demons? When I choose to take for myself at the expense of others, is the spirit of survival that moves the crocodile working in me? How about when I feel threatened and respond with lethal force? In the context of the rest of nature, these spirits are absolutely essential and therefore given free rein. But in me, in man, they must be subdued by the ego and the moral order. When they are not checked, when the inmates run the prison, a very real possession has taken place. If so, we might ask, what makes our ego spirit any different, any more valuable than these lesser spirits? We might even ask why the spirit of the self or ego is necessary at all. It doesn't exist in the crocodile after all, and their species has survived 95 million years. The spirit of the self, however, does something the others do not. And that something is related to the claim in Genesis that we are made in God's image. The self subdues and organizes the spirits within us. The self creates a hierarchy and reigns over the spirits as the Most High. It decides between competing motivations and rules them all. If this model is correct, it brings into stark focus another myth about demons. In fact, about the highest of all demons. Many will be familiar with this story, although it doesn't come directly from the Bible. In the apocryphal book of Enoch, as well as in the Quran, there is a story of the angels gathering to witness the creation of man. Now, after God makes Adam, he commands the angels to bow at man's feet. But Lucifer refuses to bow to a creation that came after him, subordinate to him, a creature made of lowly mud, where he was made from holy fire. The consequence of his pride and failure to obey is the permanent excommunication of Lucifer from heaven, effectively his conversion from high angel to archdemon. And as much as you might empathize with Lucifer here, agreeing that he was made first in pure spirit, the psychological story makes it clear. it is true that man could not exist without the spirit of self-consciousness and intellect, which Lucifer, the angel of light, represents. But it is also true that man is greater than mere intellect. Man is Lucifer, and then some. What Lucifer is, and more. A spirit, yes, but also matter. And he contains not just one spirit, but many at once. And lastly, he was made in God's image to rule over the spirits and to unite them. And so, it just might be that united with man are all the primordial spirits that God created. The Platonic ideas or living Jungian archetypes are merely different words for angels and demons.
Well, there you have it. That's one avenue explored, but infinitely more still to go. I hope you enjoyed thinking along with us. I know. It's not easy work. Thinking. It's hard and full of uncertainties, but I'm grateful for the company as we trek through this together. Here's to hoping that the juice is worth the squeeze. See what I did there? Let's find out together in the next episode.